Now entering Nerdist.com. You made it weird. You made it weird. You made it weird. Oh yeah. You made it weird. You made it weird. Yes, you did. You made it weird. Oh yeah.
You made it weird with Pete Holmes.
What's happening, weirdos? This is Alexander Shia, a Forbes recommendation for sure, friends of Rob Bell, and one of my favorite episodes in a long time, in the sense I was tearing up and really being moved and very, very profound, and really talking a lot about Joseph Campbell and all the mythologies and all the transcendent things that are just so interesting to me. And if you're into that stuff, you're about to shit in your hat. There's no ad, but the upcoming tour dates are all on PeteHolmes.com. We have San Diego for a live You Made It Weird, Montreal for a live You Made It Weird, Houston for one night, Dallas for one night, Toronto for stand-up and a You Made It Weird, and Utah for stand-up. Hope to see you out at all of those. In the meantime, please enjoy the wonderful crispiness of Alex. And I hope to see you guys out there. Thank you so much to all the weirdos that have been coming out to the live stand-up stuff. San Diego, Montreal, Houston, Dallas, Toronto, Utah. Hope to see you there. In the meantime, Alex Shia, get into it.
Anyway, it's nice to meet you. We've never met before.
We haven't.
I know very little about you, which is kind of, I kind of like doing an episode like this.
I've gotten a crash course in Pete Holmes in the last 10 days.
Yeah, you wrote me an email, and I only partially read it because I didn't want to know too much about you. But you said, the first line was something like, I just got introduced to your fans.
Your fans are writing me.
What do you mean?
We have mutual fans.
Okay.
Hi, Mike in New York.
We have mutual fan.
Yeah.
Mike in New York wrote you.
Yes.
And what did he say?
Well, he's a big fan of yours.
Uh-huh.
And I was very excited I was going to be on.
That's it?
Yeah.
So why you wrote Gulp?
Well, I mean, he went on and on and on and on and told...
Oh, he's a nut.
Told many stories.
About me?
About your show.
He wanted to give you a heads up? Was that the spirit of it?
Well, yeah, he was trying to pump me up for it.
Pump you up for it?
Yeah.
What a bizarre thing, undertaking to be like, Alex is not pumped up enough. I'm going to write him an email.
Yeah.
So he told you, what do you know? What did he tell you? I'm just curious.
Well, he considers himself a weirdist. Is that the word? Weirdo or weirdist?
If he said weirdist, then he's paving his own ground. He's blazing a trail. It's the Nerdist Theater, and it's weirdos. Okay.
Yeah, I loved I was going to take a picture of the sign out front.
Meltdown Comics?
The Nerdist stage.
Yeah.
It's like next door.
We're right above it.
Yeah.
We're about the green room right now. Yeah.
I finally come home.
You feel like a nerd?
Yeah. Yeah, but there wasn't the word for that when I was growing up.
Of course not. It just meant Asperger's.
Yeah.
It really did. When you watch movies like Revenge of the Nerds, it's like, oh, this guy only likes thinking rationally. He loves kind of mundane tasks and doing repetitive things. It's like we called those nerds, and then the jocks didn't understand them. And now we have all these diagnoses for these folks. Okay. And then nerd obviously has been broadened out to mean people that like nerd culture, which is mainstream culture, obviously.
Sort of.
Comic book movies, the biggest movies we got.
Yeah, true.
I mean, my parents don't like them. But they don't like anything.
Well, I won't ask how old they are.
73 and 75, I think.
Okay.
But they don't like anything.
Right.
It's not like Agatha Christie is blowing their hair back either. Mm. Well, what makes you a nerd?
Well, because I grew up in Alabama, and I didn't fit into anything.
Yeah.
So Birmingham was a very strange place to grow up in the 1950s and 60s.
I have to imagine so.
Yeah.
So, and what is your descent? Rob told me you are...
First generation Lebanese.
Lebanese, that's right. And so that already is kind of putting you on in an outsider sort of feeling?
In Alabama in those days, absolutely.
Yeah. And what brought your family there?
So my grandparents came, the whole Ellis Island story, bringing my parents as children because they were starving.
They did what now?
But they brought my grandparents came bringing my children in their bringing my parents
their children
in their arms
because they were starving and then they just kind of wound up in Alabama.
Birmingham was economic opportunity.
Hmm.
Steel mills were blazing. It was before World War I, and so they went to Birmingham because there was jobs.
Wow, that's crazy.
And then after World War I, the economy crashed. And Birmingham became a very different sort of a city.
Everyone lost their jobs? Not everyone, certainly, but
people lost their jobs.
Yeah,
and the power structure of Birmingham became very concerned about this immigrant city, which they had created, and essentially sort of gave the golden handshake to the KKK.
Yikes. That's not fun.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. Was that a reality? That's such a fantasy to people my age. The KKK is just characters in, like, the Malcolm X movie, and you know what I mean? Like, it's a real thing, obviously.
Well, it was a real thing. My parents described going to church at 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday because they had to be home, because Catholics, especially Lebanese Catholics, had to be home before sunrise. And
For safety reasons,
a couple of men would be excused from attending church to stand outside and make sure that people's cars didn't slow down to write down license plates.
No.
Oh, yeah.
That's wild.
Yes. And my grandmother's house was burned by the KKK or a KKK-like organization in the late 50s.
No. I don't even know what to say to that. That's crazy. Her house was burned down.
Yes.
And how did that affect things?
Well, I mean, interestingly, that after World War II, the civil rights movement really began to speed up. And that's when the oppression got ugly.
Hmm.
Because as long as the people in Birmingham were obeying the unjust laws, there was stability. But as soon as World War II was over, servicemen came back from the war and said, "We're not putting up with this anymore."
Hmm.
And then the 1950s were very ugly for a lot of us.
Hmm.
And in Birmingham, the word colored meant anybody who was not white. And that included Jews, Lebanese, Greeks, most Southern Europeans with darker skin who were Catholic or Orthodox and not WASPs.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
That's interesting. I remember I went to Africa and they were like, don't use the term non-white. That's the worst term you can say.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not the worst term, but I mean, like, it's such a dismissive, acceptable thing to say.
Yeah.
Oh, these non-white people can, yikes, because that's what you're talking about, a catch-all that meant non-WASPs.
Right.
And where are you now? I'm realizing, like, who are you? give me a little info.
What am I going to do when I grow up?
We started with your past, and before we finish the past, because that is very, very interesting, I want to know where we ended up. You're a man who has a house in Santa Fe and a room in Melbourne.
Right.
And you know Rob, and Rob – and we both know Rob.
Both know Rob.
Yeah.
So I wrote this book that Harper bought 5 years ago, and I packed a bag in January of 2010. And went out on the road, and basically I'm still on the road taking this message everywhere.
For 5 years?
For 5 years.
Oh, my goodness. And what's the book called?
The Harper book is The Hidden Power of the Gospel. And then last year it was reissued, re-edited, a few new chapters put in it, and came out as Heart and Mind.
Came out again?
Yes.
Heart and Mind.
Heart and Mind.
Why was that? I'm interested in that. Marketing reasons?
There was being on the road as much as I've been. I've learned better ways to say it, better ways to introduce the idea.
Well, I'll tell. Yeah,
and I wanted the chance to add a couple of chapters at the beginning of the book, and to do some small edits all the way through.
Hmm.
And I like the phrase "heart and mind" a lot more than "hidden power of the gospel."
Well, I'll tell you that, you know, this is a. I don't even like this term, but this is a secular podcast. Obviously,
yeah.
A lot of people listening are probably going to be atheists. A lot of people listening are a lot of people I think I attract are formerly religious, spiritually seeking people. And when you say the hidden power of the gospel, people hear the gospel and then they're
out of here.
They're out of here. Yeah.
Well, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
See ya.
Because it's been ruined. It's been Xeroxed and Xeroxed and Xeroxed and Xeroxed and Xeroxed and Xeroxed and taken over by groups and fundamentalists and people that have really bastardized this.
Well, and
message.
I've got the greatest job and the hardest job, and I don't mean no violins playing. But to go out and to say that there might be something in this text which is really fun and really vital and really new, it's a hard sell.
Yeah. And what are you fighting? Not fighting, but are you bumping against fundamentalism?
I'm bumping against everything.
What do you
really
mean?
Because I mean, the thing that I'm having fun with is that nobody can characterize this yet. Mm. It's like, is this left? Is this right? Is this centrist? Is this? It doesn't fit any of the categories. And then, it's fun and it's vital.
Okay, so tell me, tell the people. I know a little bit about it. So tell the people. Tell the people.
Well, okay, so let's start with when I was in college. I had the great fortune of attending a series of lectures of Joseph Campbell.
Which is one of the reasons why Rob really lit up and was like, well, you got to talk to this guy.
I mean, and Campbell spun my world.
Yes.
Because he starts talking about the great human story that's everywhere.
Right.
And, of course, he brings it down to the simplest metaphor is there are four steps in the great story. You hear the summons, you face obstacles, you receive the boon, you return with the boon to serve community.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I'm a little Catholic guy at the University of Notre Dame. Go Irish. And I'm listening to this, and I'm wondering, okay, if this is the great human story, if this story is everywhere, does it have a connection with, quote-unquote, the gospel? And we've got four gospels, and do those line up in any way with this great story that Campbell so inspired me?
Right. Campbell himself would say yes, right?
Absolutely. And what Campbell showed was Campbell showed the journey in each one of the four texts,
mm-hmm.
those texts that Christians call Matthew, Mark, John, and Luke. I kept thinking there's a larger story here, and I for 30 years I tried to force it, I tried to create it. I have enough integrity that ultimately when it wouldn't work, I would stop and like, okay, Shia.
What does that mean?
What?
Trying to force?
Because the intuition was that the four gospels form a larger story in the great mythic story that Joseph Campbell describes.
Because I know what you're talking about, but it is right. Interesting that the New Testament starts with the Gospels, which is the same story. Essentially, I know there are differences, but essentially it tells the story of Jesus four times.
Right.
And there are differences. And right. And it is an interesting thing, especially as a young man, being like, why are there two creation stories? And then why are there four Jesus stories? And was this a mistake? Like, honestly, there was so much deliberation put into this process of making a holy book. Why did they include four? Right. And so you started trying to find the kind of Campbellian reasoning?
As I listened to Campbell and I knew the text well enough, I kept saying, there's a connection here.
Mm.
Somehow these four texts make a larger story.
Interesting.
It's not just four texts about Jesus because, really, folks, why would you need four? I mean, really, if you're just looking for the truth, give me the story.
Well, the Western mind these days, if we had these stories, we would turn them into a best of. We'd call it into a now that's what I call Jesus compilation.
Yeah.
And it would be one story because right. It would be like, why? And they contradict each other. You have to understand, when I say that, I don't have a problem with that. People love being, like, you know, Jesus says, if they're not for us, they're against us in one gospel. And in another one, he says, if they're not against us, they're for us.
Right.
So we literally have the different accounts, which everyone knows were written 150 years after this guy's death anyway. So any sort of journalistic integrity is thrown out, and we're dealing with myth.
Right. And what our listeners can't see is I'm sitting here wildly nodding yes.
Yes. Because, you know, it's interesting to me, you throw the word myth at a lot of religious people, and I'm speaking from experience, you get upset people because you think you're saying, hey, don't put my God over with Santa Claus and right. The Tooth Fairy. Right. That's insulting to me. Whereas I think someone like Campbell, and it sounds like you, are saying there are things that are more true than literally true. And the devices that we have to share these stories are stories, legends, poetry, music, these things that transcend reason in the rational mind and the dualistic mind.
Right.
Boom.
Right. So for myth to me is the ultimate truth. Mm. And myth is, if there is one spirit in the universe, then there's just one story, although it's got a couple hundred billion scripts.
Isn't that great?
It's heavy. I mean, I love the diversity.
Yeah.
But they're all telling the same story.
That's right. It's one consciousness, our consciousness, right, expressing itself over and over and over. Something I said to Rob recently, I was like, if everyone died except for a couple kids and they knew language and stuff, you know, like, let's get some of those particulars out. If we started civilization over with some children that knew language and had resources, in about 150 years would have a new hero's journey, would have a new story that they probably would tell.
Yes, and the way that I describe that is the hero's journey that Joseph Campbell described is responding to the way energy moves in the world, the way energy moves in the cosmos. What makes the story true is that energy is true, and the way it moves is true.
Yeah.
And so you can tell a story for a while that doesn't adhere to the way energy moves, but ultimately people will know. It's like, oh, it leaves me flat, or there's something missing.
It doesn't resonate.
It doesn't resonate.
Yeah. So these stories that aren't factually true, which is what we're so obsessed with, again, going back to the dual mind, it's either true or false, it's either real or fake. Jesus was either whatever, a lie or real, or a story, yeah, or a fact, or the real true God or not. But then there comes this middle place, and that's what myth keeps pointing us back to, is the both and place.
Right. And I grew up as a Lebanese Semite, and Semite refers to all the village people of the Middle East. The Lebanese, Palestine, Jewish, Jordanians were all Semites.
I didn't know that. So if I'm mean to you, I'm an anti-Semite?
Yes.
Get out of here, you Lebanese.
Exactly.
That's crazy. I didn't know that.
So in the old world, here's how a Semite tells the story. A Semite has total permission to change the facts to convey the right emotion.
Get out of here, man.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. I'm a poor person,
yep,
and I just got robbed of a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm talking to another poor person, I'm going to tell him I just got robbed of a dollar because he knows what a dollar means to me.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm talking to the richest villager, I'm not going to say I just got robbed of a dollar. I'm going to say I just lost $10,000.
That's right.
Or $100,000 or whatever.
Right.
Because what's true is to convey the emotion of what I'm feeling, mm-hmm, not the facts.
And when you're talking about the cosmos, Campbell and Carl Jung and all these people talk about the inner world. You're talking about the cosmos and the laws of the universe, and also this inner world. We talk about how much of our consciousness is subconscious and the shadow and the self, and that it all gets interpreted through the ego and all that. So the myth and these stories and the $1 or $10,000 are our attempt to communicate with ourselves.
Yes.
And that's why we get the tingles,
yes,
when Iron Man shoots the aliens,
yes,
because we know that it's an invitation for us to go inside and fight our own aliens.
Yes.
That's why when you say it's either with the energy or it's not with the energy, it's not real. It's better. It's true. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, we got hung up.
And these figures are about inspiring us to our own nobility.
That's right. Can I put this to you? This is something I've been kicking around lately. What I think Campbell does for me is it takes the Christian message that I was given and says, here's a guy named Jesus, and he is God, and he does miracles, and he, you know, becomes a realized being and realizes his oneness with God. And then our calling is to worship this thing and go like, he did it. He did it. And then we die and we go to heaven and we spend the rest of eternity going, he did it. He's the best. Whereas myth, boring, right?
Yeah.
Fucking boring.
It is.
And myth.
At least I'm bored.
When we take that fish and put it back in the myth ocean where it belongs, suddenly an interesting thing happens. We're invited to the party. We realize that it's not Jesus going like, oh, look at how great he was. Let's spend the rest of our days explaining how great he was. He's saying, go and do likewise.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
That's the juice.
And not go and do exactly like I do. Go and do it in your own unique, authentic, real way.
That's right. That's right. Your karma,
yes,
to use,
yes,
another story. What? Your life.
Yeah.
Your purpose. Right.
I like clothes, but I don't particularly like togas. I have no desire to eat laying down, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. But that's getting lost at the point.
Yes.
We're losing the point.
Yeah.
And it's getting robbed of all this richness. Why did this tradition survive all these thousands of years? Why do people still feel things when these stories are told over and again? It's not because they're literally true. It's not a news story. It's not a science textbook. It's poetry and it's myth.
Right.
I love it.
I mean, for me, as a devout Christian, and I will say that, although I would say that the institution probably wouldn't recognize, but it's very important to me that Jesus was born, that we have the body of his teachings, died, and rose. Mm. The rest of it is about inspiring me to live my life in that same way.
That's interesting, because as somebody that grew up religious and the church recognized me as far as I know, I've had great pleasure through Campbell in going, Christ's death and resurrection is itself a metaphor that we are to die. They've heard me say this a million times, die to our own humanity, our lower self, and yes, raise to our divinity,
yes,
our purpose, our connection,
yes,
our oneness with the one, yes, consciousness. So then I luckily get this get out of jail free card where I go, there doesn't have to be a man from Nazareth who was literally crucified, bled out, and died, and was buried, and came again, because that story has been told over and over and over. We have all these other myths that predate the Bible. Again, this is deconstructionism. It's less interesting to me. But it's like virgin births, sinless life, physical death and resurrection. We keep telling this story. And Campbell would point to the harvest. We learned agriculture. We learned death and the seed and goes in the ground and grows again. So then we start seeing that in the stories. But you, I don't want to say holding on because that sounds condescending. You are holding on, I don't know how else to say it, to the idea that there was a man named Jesus who died and rose again.
That's important to me. I don't have a problem with it not being important to somebody else.
No. That's interesting.
I mean, what compels my desire to live nobly is knowing that there are other humans who have done it.
Mm. That's what Rob says. Rob says we lose something if these stories didn't happen to real people. Is, yeah, that kind of what you're feeling?
Yes. I mean, there are a couple of great myths that I have right at the core. Mm. And Jesus the Christ is the center of that core. But the myth of Inanna from the Sumerian tradition, and the myth of the Dine Bahane from the Navajo in the Southwest.
I'd really love for you to tell both of those.
Both of those are so true. But they don't have the further aspect that I find in Jesus the Christ, which is a full human being walking this path here in our midst.
Mm.
And Inanna is the queen of heaven. The Dine Bahane is about the warrior twins at the beginning of time who made this level of reality safe enough for us to live in.
Mm.
Jesus the Christ was living within the ordinary travails of life in the first century in a place at the end of the Mediterranean.
Sorry, I got distracted by somebody needing to get in the studio.
Yeah.
Did she need it? I'm not going to lose my train of thought. Hello.
We have a presence arriving?
Yeah, we need gifts.
Right.
It's funny, I was just reading or listening to Ram Dass talking about how you shouldn't. One of the spiritual practices of the East was not to accept or give gifts because it heightens the separation. You are giving something to me, and one of the disciplines is to go, no gifts. Like, you are me, and I am you, so let's get that out of here. Speaking of spiritual traditions, I wonder if that is just part of your practice. It's almost like, okay, so Christ was either, now we're going into the dualistic place, he was either real and walked among us and died and rose again, or that is a story. And, you know, we can say for the sake of this conversation that there's no real way to ultimately know. You know what I mean? Aside from time travel. So you're kind of, it sounds to me like part of your practice, just like you could say, I'm a meditator, or this is the story I put in my heart. You're taking it in that way because that's the most beneficial to you. And it, you don't sound too hung up on being like, let's analyze the Shroud of Turin for DNA. That doesn't seem like your thing.
No, because I know the story is true, and I'm pointing to my gut and my heart here.
Yeah.
I know it is.
Right.
It's the greatest truth of every person and every particle of the cosmos.
So we agree that if Christ were real and walking around, that makes the story better. We both agree. But is there anything other than that gut feeling that it's better when it's true that makes you think that it's true?
you're messing with my Semitic mind.
It doesn't matter?
Wait, it doesn't matter to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, as a semi to look at that question, and it's like you're splitting heart and mind.
And you don't want to do that.
Well, that it's just not authentic to me.
Yeah. See, I think that's interesting. You talk about a Native American tradition, that idea that everything has the literal world and then everything also has the spiritual reality concurrent with that. And we have lost that. I think you'd agree.
Yes.
And
yes.
Go. Unless.
Well, we've lost the mythic aspect of living.
Mm-hmm.
That we're living an ordinary life, but there's also something very profound and universal that's also happening in each life.
Isn't that something that Campbell says is that the purpose of all myth is to point to the idea that there's something beyond the physical reality that's controlling the world and controlling you? I believe that's a pretty good quote. Right. I did my best to quote.
Yes.
So, and we're losing that.
Yeah.
Go.
And I mean, I would hear, at least in the early years, Joseph would talk a lot about how we understood the word mythos in Greek, which means to either groan or moan.
Is that right?
Yes. And he would say that until you find the way the story groans or moans in you, it's not true.
Mm.
It's just words, or it's someone else's story.
It's so funny.
But it's not your story.
It's got to make you groan.
It's got to make
this
you groan.
This is why you're yawning when I say, let's just celebrate that Christ did it.
Yeah.
He's saying, join me.
Yeah.
Join me in the narrative.
Join me in the great story of the cosmos that you are living.
Because it's your story.
Right.
It's your story.
It's your story.
And myth gives you that place.
And you've got your unique way of living that story.
Right. It doesn't have to be some Anglo-Saxon, waspy churchgoer that sings certain songs. No. You can do it as authentically.
I have a long background in psychology. I did a fair amount of Jungian work, both personally and in as a therapist. And then I evolved for myself into something called sand play.
What's that mean?
Sand play was a form of Jungian work that was developed by a woman in Switzerland.
Oh, you do you literally play with sand?
Play with figures in sand.
Yes.
And one of the things that I learned is that early on when people are making a series of these images is that the early images show the deep mythic story that's there in themselves as a seed.
Mm.
But as the scenes go forward, that seed flowers into something that is absolutely unique and distinct and authentic for them.
So it starts in this sort of communal area. Have an ache.
It starts as a universal, sort of amorphous.
Yeah.
And then it grows into something that's just yours.
A unique way. Oh, they need me to move my cart. Can you do it? You got to turn the wheel to start it. Sorry, Aristotle. sorry, I parked two people in. I'm a real piece of shit. What did you do? Oh, so going back to Jung and stuff, and everything that I ever say about Jung is I either got from Richard or from Joseph Campbell.
Yeah.
Although I just bought the Big Red Book because it has some really trippy.
I got that for Christmas.
Is that really?
Yeah.
It's really trippy.
For me, it's confirming everything that I thought about Jung through sand play. But it's sort of rewriting much of what we've thought about Jung.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, what is it? Because I'm looking forward to reading it. It's basically, it's like his dream journals.
It's his dream journals, but a very interesting thing happened in Jung. I mean, this is my understanding of what happened over the course of his life. He had this phenomenal interior truth, which was written in the Red Book.
Mm.
And then as he grew and developed, he made a lot of accommodation to the science and the religion of the day and began to codify something that's best not codified to try to explain what he was experiencing to others.
So the Red Book is kind of like the purest form of it?
The Red Book is that core seed.
Hmm.
And what a phenomenal, I mean, we can imagine now what Jungian thought would have been if it had stayed at the Red Book rather than develop its theoretical constructs.
Hmm. But those things kind of squeeze some of the juice out of it.
It squeezes, but I mean, the path of religion. You start with this numinous, lively, vitale, erotic stuff at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then it starts.
Pasteurized.
Yeah.
This is my whole life's passion. I'm being real.
No.
It gets pasteurized, homogenized, and reduced into the least compelling thing.
Yes.
Afterlife insurance, ethics. Joseph Campbell was.
I love that phrase.
Thank you. He's the first person I know that was just like, Western religion has been reduced to ethics.
Yes.
Nobody else really has that big hang-up. Can I look at internet porn?
Yeah.
My whole spiritual journey from, I'm not trying to be crass here, from the age of whatever, 13, till I was 28, was whether or not I was masturbating. Because that was how I thought God saw me. The fucking most boring. That's the groan and the moan right there. That is the sound to make when you see something that was precious. Get turned in with language and structure and institution. And we talk about this a lot with Rob. Yeah. Suddenly a pastor wants to talk about mystery or doubt and he's fired?
Yeah.
Or he loves gay people or he doesn't think in a literal eternal torment hell for non-believers? And he's fired? And he loses his house because he was making $30,000 a year and they pay for his house because it's a mega church? And you're fucked? It's so sad. So it's so refreshing. This is why we have to talk.
Well, I mean, and again, here's the gift of quote unquote the KKK.
Mm.
They kept my Lebanese family very tight in Birmingham, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in the old village, even though it was in the middle of an industrial society.
Mm.
I grew up in the old ways. I grew up in the Semitic metaphor. My language is poetry and circular logic. It's not linear. When I went to Notre Dame and I discovered there was this Western world, it was the biggest crisis of my life.
No, really? Oh, culture shock.
I was a pretty bright kid. I almost flunked my first philosophy course. I could not understand the metaphor. Logic. Semitic and Middle Eastern logic is very different from Western logic.
So suddenly you get this crash course in either or.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And linear thinking and sequential. I discovered the beauty of that, but that's not where I started.
Right. But there's something so beautiful about people like me who started my people started stuffy institutions. You know, you say go Irish. I think you're rooting for my lineage.
Right.
But there's something beautiful about me, the father of my father of my father of my father, and now I'm doing all this work, meditation and reading and introspection, trying to get where you were preserved by another fucked up, close-minded group of white people scaring people and killing people and burning down houses. In the weirdest way...
In the weirdest way.
Here we are left with kind of this secret beauty.
Yeah. Yes.
Which
I'm so grateful for because my life became a bridge.
Yes. I'm enjoying walking across it right now. So you were saying the gift of the Klan, so weird to say, was that they kind of kept you preserving, and then you go to college, and the philosophy.
Right. I grew up sitting in my my grandmother's lap.
Hmm.
And she couldn't read or write. She's still the wisest person I'll ever know.
Mm-hmm.
She would chant the Gospels to me in Arabic. We didn't have folk tales. We didn't have fairy tales. We didn't have... This is a very simple, poor life in Birmingham in those days.
Mm-hmm.
She taught me that there was something in the chanting, that there's something that moves underneath the words.
The space between the words,
which so became the anchor of my heart.
Yeah.
And then when her house is burned down, and she holds our family together, and she lifts us up, and she keeps saying, no hate, no hate.
Mm.
Everything about that chanting became true. Because in that moment, I said, I want to know how to do that.
Mm.
How can, in the moment you've lost everything in the outer world that was dear to you, how can you pick up a family and keep them moving forward?
Because she seemed to, first of all, I got chills and I'm groaning and moaning all over the place over here in that feeling true way that you talked about. Do you think she got it? She was seeing it. She was seeing, I like to use the term the cosmic joke. It's like you burned down my house. what is my house?
Yeah.
What is
yeah.
me? What is you? Yeah. What is separation? What is hate?
Right.
Aren't we all just here?
Yes.
Isn't it the moment?
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's Iron Man with the aliens, and in this case, it's the KKK, and we have to go in and we have to conquer these dragons, right?
Yeah. She just had this enormous heart for all.
Mm.
And was not going to settle for partiality or bitterness.
The inclusive, once we start drawing those borders yeah. and say God ends here, because the really difficult thing to say is that the light of God is in everybody, including these very messed up people that are doing hateful, terrible things.
Well, the radiance is in every particle of sand, not just every human.
That's what I'm saying.
And every creature, I mean, it's everywhere
right.
now.
You can't get away from it.
No.
God becomes unavoidable.
No.
Right. So she sees that.
Well, yes. Yes. And she helped me see that.
Yes.
And that terrible moment, in the way that a 7-year-old boy can say to himself, I want to know about the God which has no boundaries, who has no lines and barricades.
Mm-hmm.
That's the God that I want to know about. That's the God I want to share with others.
That idea, another great Campbell quote, God is a metaphor for a mystery that transcends all categories of human thought, including being and non-being. When you put it that way, it's like, do you believe in a metaphor for a mystery? Suddenly that turns into, do you believe in God? And what does that mean? When I say that word, what are you picturing? What are you drawing in the sand? You know what I'm saying? Like, how are you manifesting that? And then how are you making your decision, your rational decision, whether you not believe in that or not? But if we start talking about a metaphor for a mystery, I'm quoting Deepak when he says, God becomes unavoidable when you see the wholeness. When you do see that one consciousness, suddenly you do see him in every grain of sand. And you even see him in your enemy. And I really think that's where Christ gets pretty unique, at least in what I've studied about him, when he starts saying love your enemy. That is breaking some new ground as a rabbi.
It was a huge shift in human consciousness at that point. One of the things that I keep sharing is perhaps it was there in another part of the planet, but it didn't get recorded.
Mm.
And it didn't live fully. But what we know is that it, sociologically and politically at this moment, that in the first century, through the teachings of Jesus, we have the very first attempts to have a pan-tribal community.
A pan-tribal, one world.
One world.
Yeah.
I mean, up to that point, everything was about who your mama.
Yeah.
Who's your mama?
Yeah.
Because that's where the bloodline is.
Right.
And even the organization of the pagan and the earth tribes at that point were still about bloodline, your mother, your village.
Yes.
Jesus comes along and the first followers, and they begin to do something that we don't know whether it had ever happened before. This idea that everybody, doesn't matter who your parents were, doesn't matter your village, doesn't matter your socioeconomic status, doesn't matter whether, in my belief, it doesn't matter whether you're gay or straight. None of that matters.
Right.
We've got a table that you're invited to.
Get out of here with your truth. I love it. It's really moving. Well, you're talking about, he's talking to the lepers and the prostitutes and the unclean, even the Good Samaritan. The reason Samaritan is in the title of that story is because Samaritans were shunned.
Exactly. Exactly.
Bad people.
There are no bad people.
That's
they're
right.
just people. They're just people.
That's right. And they're you.
And they're me.
They're a part of you. So when your grandmother has this compassion, she's seeing herself even in her enemy.
Right. Right.
It's hard. It is a huge shift in consciousness.
There's a second shift of consciousness, which is it. Christianity was that first tradition that said, where we put the table is our holy land.
Mm.
The Holy Land. I mean, I have a great honoring for the place where my family came from.
Mm-hmm.
Israel is not the Holy Land. Do we realize what we're saying when we say we call Israel the Holy Land, or Palestine the Holy Land, or Jerusalem the Holy City?
What's that?
It disempowers the rest of the cosmos. And this is what early Christianity had no special regard for any of that place for 400 years.
Yeah.
The Holy Land was the table where the door was open to everybody.
Mm. And even when I said, where are you from? That idea of, like, where am I from?
Yeah.
What are you asking me right now? It's such a fun little conundrum. And where is the Holy Land? Rob likes to say Moses took his sandals off not because the ground was holy, but because he realized everywhere was holy.
Sort yes. of thing. Yes.
Right?
Yes. And with no disrespect for Israel.
Yeah.
Or Afghanistan or Uruguay.
Yeah.
Every place is holy.
That's right.
Every place is holy.
And the moment is holy.
And the moment.
And Richard Rohr talks about Joseph Campbell talks about the cathedral trying to remind us of the inner cathedral, the space that we can create, for lack of a better term, through love and connection and community. And we see these beautiful buildings because they're supposed to be these little respite from the hustle and the bustle, reminding us that the respite is inside of you always. The eternal moment, the timeless moment.
Right.
Time being an abstraction, here we are pretending that it's... I know we're going around the sun, but the moment is holy, the moment is eternal. The king... So, go.
Well, I mean,
please.
I would sort of lead us back to talking about the great mythic journey and how these gospel texts express it, because it's really important, I think, today for everybody to know, as Campbell says, the journey's known. It's just a matter of whether you're going to have the courage to walk it.
Mm.
And we're in some very difficult cultural moments right now. But when you know the journey, you know, okay.
Isn't that wild?
This is what it is.
This is what we do.
This is what we do.
This is what the factory makes.
This is also how we work it out.
That's right.
We know the journey.
When me and Rob have been touring around and somebody stood up and was like, you know, my church kicked me out because I believe this, and he was their pastor. And we were like, I think it was like he didn't want to leave the church. He was tempted to stay. And we're like, you're supposed to be tempted to stay in the village. You're supposed to go, I'm going to go in the woods because I'm compelled to, this is Campbell's, to go into the woods. And everybody goes, we're having chicken tonight.
Yeah.
We're having chicken. And it's really hard to go like, no, I'm going to go into the... I always think of the movie Big Fish, which is a hero's journey. I'm going to go in the woods. I'm going to take the chicken to go. Everyone's supposed to think you're insane.
Yeah.
You're leaving the comfort of the clan. He talks about left path, right path. The myths that told you to stay with the clan and the myths that told you to leave.
Yeah.
And these great stories are the ones where we leave. We either go inside or we literally leave. So when somebody comes at me and they're like, I don't know, I feel suffocated by my church. I'm like, great. Talk to me in 5 years. I can't wait. Yes. This is it.
Yes.
You're about to start. The inciting incident has happened.
Yes, and I think it matches what you're sharing. Campbell talks about the first part of the journey is hearing the summons.
Mm-hmm.
The detail that the text of Matthew gives us is we often hear the summons in the middle of being betrayed.
Hmm.
And either when we recognize or feel that another has betrayed me, or when I recognize how I've betrayed another.
A divorce, loss of a job,
right.
Loss of something.
Right.
Death. Yes.
And so this text of Matthew, the whole text, is about waking up. It's about everybody waking up. It's given to us in these Semitic stories, which come out of a particular moment in time, but it's the spiritual practice of waking up and what it costs us to try to wake up.
Yes. Which is... a lot.
Yeah. So Matthew opens the story by giving us the text of Joseph. Doesn't give us the text of Mary, but gives us the text of Joseph at the birth of Jesus.
Right.
Joseph's got the cushy job. Joseph's on Easy Street. Joseph is part of the line of David. Joseph is a citizen of Bethlehem. And he's had the great good fortune to be betrothed to Mary, who is of the priestly line. Maybe it's not quite Kate and Will, but this is a royal Jewish couple.
Interesting.
And
so you're talking about the part of the gospel, the beginning, that most people just skip. They're like,
right.
Get to the ethics. Tell me if I should.
Because the whole dilemma of Matthew was right there in the opening story.
Mm-hmm.
Because Joseph now has got to decide whether to keep Mary who's pregnant. Because if he does, he's going to bring shame on his father. And I'm a Semitic son, and I know that my very first obligation is to keep my father's honor. And Joseph has got to make this terrible decision to go against his father, to go against the tribe, and to keep Mary. And if he does, he's going to be shunned and shamed.
Because nobody's going to believe that the Holy Ghost impregnated her. Right?
Oh, would you?
No.
I mean, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we were all reading the story from the back, you know, back to the beginning.
Yeah.
Nobody would believe this.
Right, right, right.
And it really, and the impact of Joseph is, just think, that woman who stood up and asked that question is feeling betrayed by her church. Hmm. The first Christian Jews who were hearing this text felt betrayed by their fellow people because the temple in Jerusalem had just been destroyed and the Jewish priesthood had been massacred. And all the Jews at that point were saying, we've got to go back to Jerusalem. We've got to rebuild the temple. We've got to resecure the covenant of Abraham. That's our obligation. And the Christians were saying, I think we're hearing about the Spirit of God inside us. We're hearing about a temple that is in people, not in
bricks. That can't be knocked down.
Yeah.
This sounds very, I'm not even trying to be funny, very much like Star Wars.
Yeah.
All the Jedis get slaughtered, and they're like, we need to rebuild. And then they're like, no, it's in us.
So the whole text of Matthew, it gives us story after story and meditation after meditation on betrayals. Mm. Because every time that you are really called to move forward, you've got to betray something. There's this feeling about, if I move forward, I make yesterday wrong.
That's, oh boy, that's some good stuff right
there. Well.
And betraying your, and here's Joseph, who's always been a minor character in the Christ story to me, making a really big, if we look at it time and place, a really big statement of saying, no, this is kind of what we always talk about, this Jesus saying, I came to turn brother against brother. Because change, you're not growing if you're not losing friends. You're not changing if you're not, you know, getting right. your family upset with me. Right. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I do mean me.
Right.
So keep going, right. please. Betrayals.
So one of the threads through this text that we call Matthew, which I really call the text of either waking up or facing change, because we need to take it away from all the what did Jesus know, what was Jesus thinking, and just understand that the text itself is about the noble practice of facing change and waking up. And so in this, only in this text are we going to hear Jesus say things like, well, the law and the prophets have said, but now I say to you. Because when we're at a growth moment, we've got to step over a threshold. We've got to move beyond what we were thinking and feeling yesterday. And
now I say to you.
And now I say to you.
Yeah.
And yeah, I know the journey well enough to know that down the road, yesterday is going to be confirmed, but in a radically new way. And I can't get there by holding on to yesterday. I've got to respectfully let it lie fallow for a while.
Yeah. That's kind of the leaving the village.
Yes.
That's going.
Yeah.
But, of course, the hero's journey ends, Return of the Jedi.
Right.
You come back.
You come back.
And there's an Ewok party.
Right.
So you're saying, let's leave the village, not to burn it and salt the earth and scorn it. I talk about this all the time, the idea that when I was raised, I thought of God as a bearded man in the sky. And now I've kind of come back to a place where I'm like, if that's what gets you there, if that's what plants the seed, who cares? You know what I mean? Whereas I used to scoff at it, and I did want to salt the earth and torch it and be like, what a bunch of child's play and nonsense. Now I kind of like to think I see the value in that, at least as a childish understanding.
Right.
Right? Inclusive.
Right.
Transcend and include?
Transcend and include.
So
there's this beautiful sort of signature moment late in Matthew. It's right at the arrest scene. And the writer, the author, names Judas at that moment. And Jesus says, look, the betrayer is at hand.
This is pre-everything. This is early on?
This is right where Jesus is about to be arrested.
Oh, okay.
And then this next line is stunning. Judas arrives And Jesus says, friend, do what you have come to do. Hmm. And I'm suggesting that on this first path of hearing the summons, leaving the village, facing all the people around us who are saying, you can't do that, you don't have permission to do that, that's not right thinking, that we have to accept the pain of that moment and look into it and say, friend, do what you have come to do.
Hmm. It's the mystical thing that I see time and time again of not resisting.
Yes.
It's this idea that life is happening, and Jesus, in that moment, I guess in our Western way, it should be like he should run or something. Like it should be like an action movie where he runs, but he sees the game. He sees the joke. He sees whatever you want to call it, and doesn't resist.
No, he meets it,
mm-hmm.
and in fact even kisses it.
Because,
and the thing is, we don't have to like the betrayal. We don't have to agree to. We don't have to go into the morality of it. No, none of that. Stop all the yeah.
Yeah.
Look into the feeling and say, okay, I have my work to do.
There's this great, I'm compelled to share this. It's a little kind of off subject, but on subject. Did you see the movie Once?
Yeah.
So there's this great song in it called Leave. And it's about someone breaking her heart. And the chorus is, you've said what you had to, now leave. Like, it's this idea, like, I get it. You did what you came to do. Now, please just give me the dignity of grieving alone. Like,
yeah.
But not resisting it, really.
Yeah.
There's something beautiful when you hear someone being like, I get it. This is life. There's heartbreak. There's betrayal. There's pain. There's loss. There's joy. There's ecstasy. There's rapture. But I'm not resisting any of it. I am it.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're probably beginning to see that when I look at these texts, I'm not looking at the life of Jesus. I'm looking at how the author, the phenomenal authors of these texts, took a moment inside of us and told a whole story of that moment.
Mm.
So when we get to the very end of this text that we call Matthew, we've got Jesus risen on the mountain. I love this piece. Jews name mountains, and especially if they're sacred, they name them and they build temples there. The evangelist doesn't give us the name of this friggin' mountain. It's the whole reason that this new place that we're being called to is nowhere back there that we can name.
There you go.
We've got to go forward.
He didn't spill his wine on the name of the mountain.
Mm,
and he knew what he was doing leaving it out.
Absolutely.
Because the temple's inside.
The temple is inside. I mean, to a people right now who have just lost the temple in Jerusalem, they've just had their priesthood massacred. Not to name the mountain that Jesus is on?
Yeah, absurd.
Absolutely absurd.
Right. Oh, man, this is some good juice.
But Jesus, this, because really this is not the end of the gospel, it's the end of the first chapter. It's the end of the hearing the summons.
Matthew.
And Jesus now is going to send the disciples out. Jesus says, go everywhere. I can hear my Arabic sith though go, Shua? And I can't say exactly what that means on the air.
I think you can.
But it would be close to WTF.
Okay.
I go everywhere?
Mm.
This is insanity.
Mm.
I'm in this traumatized moment of having lost my history. I want to know where to go. I want to know how long it's going to take to get there. I want to know what the resources are.
Like 40 years in the desert.
Yeah.
Where are we headed?
Where are we headed?
Yeah.
All right. So when we're reading this text as a continuous story, and we now know that in Campbell's map, we're leaving the summons, we're leaving the village, and now we're going to that place where we're going to face obstacles.
Mm. Mark.
Yes.
This is so interesting. I've never even thought of looking at the four as one story in fortune. Because Matthew has the crucifixion, has the resurrection.
Right, but it's
so you think that's the end of the movie?
No, it's the crucifixion and the resurrection and hearing the summons.
I think
it's,
I understand.
It's the whole journey that we make to wake up and go, all right, I'll take this trip, even though I don't know where it's going.
Okay. So that's that's here's an interesting expression. So that's that crucifixion.
Yeah.
And then we come to
because once you hear about the crucifixion, it's like, well, all right. So I know about it. Where do I go with it?
Right.
But each crucifixion in the four texts is the passion of that place in you. Each one's got a very different content, a very different feeling, a very different journey that you have to walk inside yourself.
And it's pointing to another thing that's in you. It's an active call.
Right.
To you.
It's your call to live a noble life.
There you go. Not hooray, Jesus did it.
No.
And thank you for saving us with a magic prayer.
Oh, gosh. Don't get me started on that one.
As long as you say the words, you believe. Your work is done. Well, that is the least compelling hero's journey. What? You're in a village and someone goes, believe in Jesus, and you go, got it, and then you eat the chicken. Oh, it's so good
to
meet you.
Or we're going to go do a psychodrama of what Jesus went through rather than doing our own.
That's right. I said something to Rob the other day, and we were just laughing about Jesus saying, a modern-day Jesus, 2015 Jesus going, why are you still talking about me? Like, don't you see? It was you to do this. Like, take the ball and run with it. He handed us the ball, and we've been telling stories about the quality leather on the ball. Like, look at the ball. Right. Look at that stitching.
Right.
You were supposed to run with the ball.
Right.
Yeah. Further than your parents.
Well, I'm going to do a segue right here. Bird.
Yeah.
Because I'm often asked out there on the road, well, because I believe that the early Christians knew about the journey. They knew in their metaphor that it had these four aspects to it.
Yeah.
And people, well, where did it come from? It came from Judaism. It came from Pesach. It came from Passover.
Mm.
But it's...
This whole story.
This whole story, but we got
the
stuck
Christ story,
because we keep... Now, the journey, this idea of the journey... Christians in the first century knew that the journey with Jesus had these four aspects to it because they knew the four aspects from the Jewish story of Passover.
Interesting.
Because Passover at the time of Jesus was nothing like Passover now. If you want to know what Passover was like at the time of Jesus, don't go read the Haggadah script.
How different was it?
Before the temple was destroyed.
Was there horseradish?
You know, we're not certain.
So before the temple, please, don't let me stop you from saying this interesting stuff with my goats.
There was a lamb or a goat prepared.
Yeah.
It had been sacrificed at the temple that day. There seems to be almost no other rituals other than the family is gathered.
Hmm.
And this is during the time that Judaism had become Greekicized, Hellenized. And they were doing the Socratic method.
Hmm.
So during the meal, the head of the household would say something like, we know that our ancestors were slaves in Egypt and that Moses arose and that they had to make a decision to leave. Where in your life today are you a slave? And are you making a decision to wake up? Now, that's my languaging.
Yep.
But this was not a telling of history. It was a living of it.
They were doing
this whole meal was about the mythic journey in them as a family right now.
As a means to becoming a realized person.
As a means to becoming a realized person. This was like the personal communal awareness festival about what are we really doing here,
folks. I want to go to that. I've been invited to a few Passovers, but I've never been invited to a universal awareness festival.
Yeah.
But this is what we're talking about. Yeah.
So there's a sharing around the table, and then the head of the household is going to give them the second question. Those of our ancestors who left Egypt with Moses went out into the wilderness, and they wandered for 40 years, and they unto a physical or an emotional or a spiritual death.
Mm-hmm.
What wilderness are you wandering in today? Mm. Talk around the table. Back to the head of the household. We know that our ancestors came across the Jordan into the promised land. What new promise, what new vitality are you experiencing today? Mm. Talk. Late in the evening, we're now at the end of the Passover celebration, and the head of the household is going to say, now that we've come to the end of this Passover meal, what new action of spirit are you committing yourself to in service of self and other this year?
Mm-hmm.
Talk, talk, talk around the table. Suggesting is that...
It's like a quadruple Thanksgiving. Like, what are you thankful for?
Yeah.
Like, you really have to keep... We really phone that in. I go, like, food and family. But now you have to kind of, like, go in. But it's not about the performance of it having a good answer. It's about finding an authentic answer.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Not impressing your neighbor with your turn of phrase. Right. Yeah, that's fascinating. So they knew... So, this is where you think they knew...
The four parts of the hero's journey.
From Passover.
And through Jesus' death and resurrection, they didn't need to rewrite the journey. They needed to add further reflection.
Mm.
And so everything that early Christianity did was in fours, not threes, but fours.
Comedy, we do rule of threes.
Oof.
Gospel, we did rule of fours.
Right.
Great. So this is why there's four Gospels.
That's what
and
I'm.
Four parts.
That's what I'm suggesting.
You
is
get
is
out
that,
of here. No, I love they, it. I'm saying you get out of here because it's just the greatest thing ever.
They knew the great story.
Yeah,
and so they were looking for the texts that told that part of the story.
And so this is where we get the need for Mark. Right, we're on Mark.
Yeah,
which, if I can draw my own little biblical knowledge, no resurrection in Mark.
You're right.
Right.
You're right.
He just dies.
He dies, and there's an empty tomb.
Oh, it doesn't. Come back, but there's an empty tomb.
There's an empty tomb.
I just.
But you don't know why there's an empty tomb.
Somebody could have stolen him.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can steal a corpse.
And the most incredible thing is that right at that moment the women flee from the tomb, and though they have been told to go out and tell people that Jesus has risen, they go out and they say nothing. And the last words of the text is, for fear and amazement have overcome them.
Wow.
And it is so powerfully true that when you're in the second part of the mythic journey and you're facing the obstacles, there's no heart and roses. There's no violins playing. There's no beautiful garden. There's no paradise. There's just navigating through the obstacles. And that's resurrection.
Hmm.
The ability to keep moving through the obstacles.
So we've gone in the woods. We heard the call with Matthew. Now we're in the woods.
Yes.
And again, I think of Big Fish. Have you seen Big Fish?
Yes.
Yeah. So he's getting picked up by gross trees, and there's giant spiders, and it's gross, and it's hard. And this is the part, we could find that part in any of these movies. But it's the part that, for lack of a better term, it sucks.
Yeah.
You're getting kicked, and you're like, why did I leave on chicken night? You're thinking your friend's eating the chicken.
Yeah.
So how does Mark start? I mean, like, is that where you start? However you want to tell me about Mark, I'm very interested.
I mean, Mark starts with John the Baptist in the wilderness, crying out in the wilderness. Hmm. And that's exactly
literally
what we have to do when we're in this time of great obstacles.
It literally starts with a man in the wilderness.
A man in the wilderness.
Yeah.
Wearing camel's hair.
Nobody likes camel's hair.
No.
That's like a fourth grade hair, yeah.
It's gross, it's itchy, it creates rashes on your skin.
And he was eating locusts.
Locusts and wild honey.
Right. And I remember when I was in Israel, they showed us those like seedlings. They look like green pea pods, but they're black. And they're like, that's kind of what a locust was. Like, basically like boiling bark.
Yes,
you're eating nothing.
But let's talk about the metaphor of locusts.
I'd love you to.
Locusts for the Hebrews were lies and falsehoods.
Hmm.
And that's what we have to discern when we're in this the second path of the obstacles, is we have to eat the lies and the falsehoods.
Interesting. To get rid of them or to see if they stick?
We have to ingest them to disperse them.
Hmm.
We can't...
We take them in.
We take them in for our own authenticity.
I love that. One of the metaphors that old Cambys liked to tell was I believe it's a leopard with the sheep, and he's hanging out with the sheep, and he's going, ba, 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 and then a male leopard shows up and grabs, he's going to kill the sheep, then he sees the leopard, and he's like, what are you doing? You're a leopard, and he takes him to his reflection, he goes, look, you're a leopard, and then he kills one of the sheep, and he gives the leopard, the small leopard, the meat, and he chokes on it. And I'm getting this from that movie Finding Joe, which is about Joseph Campbell.
Yes.
And he goes, as we all do on the truth. You're giving it, and you're eating the locust, and you're trying to find what is the food for you.
Yes.
What is your truth?
Yes.
And you choke on it.
Yes.
And that, okay. But it needs to be forced down your throat sometimes.
It does.
It did for me.
Well, I mean, we tend to overly sentimentalize these stories. Jesus puts the friggin' disciples in the boat at night in Mark and sends them out across what I call the Lake of Chaos. Because the Sea of Galilee
is
utterly dangerous at night.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, because the storms come up very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And no fisher person is going to go out on that sea at nighttime. It's dangerous enough in the day when you can see the storms forming.
What is the WTF phrase? I want to say it.
What? Ashuba.
Ashuba.
Yes.
You're going out on Galilee at night?
Ashuba. Yes. And the storm comes up.
Yes.
And the waves are coming in.
Yeah.
And Peter cries out, don't you care about us?
Jesus,
we're going down.
Isn't he?
He's not only asleep, he's asleep in the back of the boat, which is the cushy part, because it doesn't rock like the front, and he's got a pillow.
Oh, the Jesus.
Isn't this great? Our great spirit is comfortably asleep, and we're going down.
Yeah.
Now, how contemporary is that in today's crisis?
That's basically a retelling of the two sets of footprints and then one set. And the punchline is, oh, no, you were alone.
Yeah.
I was asleep in the back. Yes. So he's asleep, and it was his idea to send them out.
Yes.
Yep.
And this story gets told four times in Mark, and Jesus gets increasingly agitated.
The story got told four times?
There are four crossings in Mark.
No, I didn't
know. Jesus is increasingly agitated with the disciples.
Yeah, because he wakes up and he's...
Are you getting this?
Yeah.
I'm sending you into the storm. I am not here to save you from the storm. I'm sending you into the storm. Where is your nobility?
Mm.
I mean, nobility is a much better word in the text than faith. Faith is like the...
Mm.
Anyway, this is about you standing on your own two feet and knowing that you're part of the great mythic journey of all time.
And not avoiding the fucking storm.
And not avoiding it.
He's not... We've turned Jesus into the slot machine.
Yes.
Save me from the storm. Help me find parking.
Right.
Please help these chicken pox clear up.
Right.
And he's saying, no, don't you get it? Who says this? Change only comes from great pain or great love, right? And it's more often the first one, I think.
Yes.
So here he is going, no, deal with it.
Right.
Wake up. Right. It's not about avoiding the storm.
Right. I mean, every one of these great stories in Mark goes to the same place.
Mm.
Whether it's John the Baptist or the crossing of the sea or standing at the... where the waters of chaos are coming up out of the ground at Caesarea Philippi, et cetera. It's all about go to your deepest place of your pain and go there with the nobility of spirit and live through it.
Go, to bring Star Wars into it, go in, your Yoda's training you, go into that weird tree, fight the Darth Vader, slice him open and see in the mask that it's you.
Yes.
The hard work. You have to understand, I come from Irish Bostonians. We take huge amounts of pride in repression. I'm not trying to shit on my people, but we are not. My family still thinks it's weird that I go to therapy. I was in therapy just before this. I love it. It's hard and it's scary, but that's the tree and that's the Galilee. Yeah. Why are we going out at night?
Yeah.
We're having chicken.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get into it, man.
Yeah.
So Mark is the hardships.
Mark is the hardships.
Yeah. And then where are we?
And just to give a historical, this text is coming. It's written to the Jewish Christian community in Rome that's been condemned to die for the burning of Rome. They're horrible execution. And you can see this text as sort of the meditation on the nobility of moving through this suffering, which is unto death.
Hmm.
You, by the same reality, you can face into this, and you can make tragedy something far different.
Mm-hmm. Love it.
So then we go to the third chapter, Matthew the first, Mark the second. John's the third chapter, not Luke, John.
We're swapping. Tell me why.
Well, that...
That's
that's a big one.
The sequence in the Bible is simply the sequence of how these texts were prayed on Sundays.
Okay.
But the internal sequence of the mythic journey, John is the third chapter.
Okay.
John is the text of reaching the promised land, hearing the first new vital promise.
And John is the typically the mystical, the new agey one.
Typically.
Yeah, that's how people will kind of summarize John briefly.
Right.
But he is the one that, like, the beginning was the Word. So the beginning was a vibration, the sort of, like, string theory sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, the beginning is breath. The beginning is a flaring forth.
Yeah.
However you want to say that.
An undeniable consciousness expressing itself.
Well, yes, and what John is doing is John is writing a new Genesis.
Mm.
He's writing about the first moment of time or before the first moment of time. And the problem that many people get into is that they don't understand that John is not yet talking about Jesus. John is talking about, in his metaphor, that which came out of God, which Christianity calls the Christ, that Jesus is a visible expression of.
I love it. That's so great.
So when John is talking...
It's not his last name, folks.
No!
He's an example of the Christ.
Yes, and
he's a part of it.
He's a visible manifestation,
right? An example,
and every one of us is a manifestation. In my heart, Jesus the Christ is a full manifestation. But what's so important about John is that this breath from the first moment of time is sweeping through every particle, every cell, through all time, everywhere, not just this planet, the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
So I keep saying the cosmos is Christic in this metaphor. We've already answered about whether UFOs are filled with spirit. There's nothing in the cosmos that's not filled with spirit.
Yes, it's all that one thing.
I think I keep hearing Rob say something about everything spiritual.
Yeah.
He would like it if we said that.
You mean the Everything is Spiritual tour that's happening now?
Yes.
You know, it's funny. Yes, go on.
So what John is going to do is John is basically bringing two things back together. And the two things back together is just a metaphor for everything belongs.
Hmm.
But he's going to say throughout his text that spirit and matter are one, and they've always been one. And we just get caught in separating it out, and then we've got to wake up and see how it really is all together.
Right. As Ram Dass would say, you're a soul that takes an incarnation, then you get lost in the incarnation, and then waking up is remembering that this whole time you were a soul. And what are you even talking about? You've been sold a bill of goods, you're in a prison, you're in this thing. Campbell talks about the persona and the culture and all these different masks that we're wearing, and then to quote Deepak, we're all God in drag. Like, we're all just playing these roles.
Well,
there's jokes to be made there, but the idea that, like, oh, I'm father and you're son and you're my competitor and I'm your employee and I'm your date and I'm your baby and all this stuff is just one thing being itself over and over and over and over. And when we wake up to that, this seems to be what John is pointing to.
Yes. And I'm about to start another book on John, so I'm blank. Like, what's the best thing that I could share here? Because in Campbell's metaphor, we're talking about the third place, which is receiving the gift or receiving the boon.
Mm.
And in John, whenever Jesus calls a person's personal name, which is there are very few personal names in John. But when Jesus uses a personal name, Lazarus, Mary, people wake up.
Hmm.
And one of the most phenomenal pieces is right there at the beginning of the text when Jesus says to Simon, you are to be called Petros, Peter. But Petros is either rock or stone. In most translations of the Bible, it gets translated as rock.
Mm-hmm.
The better translation here would be stone,
because stone in the Mediterranean and stone in the Hebrew is the metaphor for gold or the diamond.
Hmm.
As a Peter,
I like this. Yeah. I like this better.
Yes. I mean, it's not Peter, you're stoned. But it's Peter, you're stone, which in that metaphor is you are made of something incorruptible.
Mm.
Nothing you ever do in your life can take away the fact that you are spirit and matter together.
Mm-hmm.
You're gold, you're a diamond, or in their metaphor, you're stone.
Yes.
And so this is the text of John is it walks around over and over again in the different meditations, bringing us back to who we truly are.
So to bring Star Wars into this, this is us figuring out that the Force is everywhere.
Yes.
And that the Force is in us, and we can, to make it more dramatic, use the Force to, say, get a lightsaber out of the snow at an opportune moment. But that's the thing. That's the boon that's going to come back in that story we've heard a billion times in a billion different ways. Here's the key. You'll know when you need it.
Right.
Here's your lightsaber. You'll know when you need it. Here's the Force. You'll know when you need it. And here we are receiving this infinite truth that something that I like to say and can't say enough is that there's nothing you can do to separate yourself from the love of being.
Absolutely.
But there are things you can do to heighten your awareness of that love.
Right.
That's what I would say. But there's nothing you can do to be apart from it. And that's the Force.
Right.
It's the Force.
And John will say that it's the Force and it's the Fourth. But when you get that awareness at another level, it comes with some sense of what your gift or your responsibility is to share with yourself and others.
Spider-Man. Great power, great responsibility.
Yes.
So now we have to take this Force and proselytize? Is that another word?
No. I mean, we've got the fourth path, but what most people miss in this third path is they get the electric feeling, but they don't sit with it long enough. They don't have a mentor or coach or a therapist or a friend or a spouse or somebody to sit and ask the questions deeply enough that they get the giftedness of it.
Mm.
The giftedness of it is different than just the scintillating wow feeling.
So that's fleeting. It's funny, you're reminding me of a meditation technique where they go, don't get distracted by the diamonds, but take the mine. That's what Maharishi said. He said, go and seize the whole thing, like a military strategy. But so, you're saying some people get caught up, and they're like, ooh, the Force, and I'm one with everything. And then they run off like idiots without – not idiots, but you know what I mean, misguided, without doing the real work.
Right.
The deep work.
But because what happens when you run off too soon is you keep coming – you keep looking for another experience to get the feeling.
Would you say it's like seed cast upon the rock?
Yeah, that's what it is.
But it goes up quickly.
Do you mean that biologically? Or?
Either way, it's a waste. But it shoots up quickly. That's Christ's a parable, obviously. But he talks about when it – I forget which soil it is, but it shoots up quickly, but there's no roots.
Right.
And then it burns up.
Right.
We call this in the Christian world someone being on fire, the new convert or whatever. But, of course, that's all baloney anyway.
Well, I mean, it's similar to in Hinduism when Kundalini is released and it shoots up through the chakras.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got to, through very steady meditation, bring the voltage down to something which can serve.
Hmm.
This is also exactly what John is describing.
Instead of just being selfishly like your own inner wizard,
right,
but finding something that actually has a practical purpose in the human consciousness,
right,
in the evolution of the world.
Right.
And not to,
and
I want to be clear, sorry, not to save souls or get people access into the eternal nightclub, but to further human consciousness.
Totally. Totally.
Again, I'm just afraid of people listening because we're talking so much Jesus, they're thinking, oh, but if I don't have this magic word and this magic prayer, I'm not invited to this party. Anybody is. And again, that's why I'm trying to bring up Star Wars. It's the same story.
It is the same story. I mean, we could sit here and I could tell you the same story through the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism.
Yes.
I could tell you the same story through Ānanda. I could tell you the same story through the Dīnābhāna.
Right. But we're culturally Christian. I was raised that way, and this is the vocabulary I'm most comfortable with. So you're just speaking to me in my language, and I appreciate it. So we're in John, and unless you're moving on, I'm not sure.
Well, just that I love how John ends, because it's so much what we were just saying. You've got Jesus and Peter at the lake, And Jesus says to Peter, "Peter, do you love me?" And Peter goes, "Gosh, you know, I've been on Pete Holmes' show. You know, it's like I'm scintillating.
Yeah, yeah.
I've had a great retreat. Yes, I love you."
Yeah.
And Jesus says, "Go take care of the sheep." This is code language. Who are the shepherds in the first century? The shepherds have been put out in the fields. They've been removed from village life because they have transgressed in some way.
Is that right?
Yes.
It was like a punishment job.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
This is the worst thing because you are going to live and smell like sheep.
Yeah.
Something very base and something very smelly.
You're going to Melbourne. Sheep shagger.
Yes.
Still an insult. Still an insult.
Well, it is. But although, don't say that in New Zealand.
Is that right? That's a big term for them, right? That's a slanderous term?
Well, I mean, sheep taking care of sheep is greatly honored in New Zealand.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Oh, I'm glad for them. So it's a punishment job, and
it's
he's
a punishment
saying,
job for thieves and thugs and gangsters and maybe even murderers and pedophiles, etc.
Mm.
And because they're out there, they're going to smell like sheep, which is better than having a bell around your neck. Because if you come into polite society, people know long before you've got there.
Yeah, there's a sheep guy coming.
There's a sheep guy coming.
Oh, boy.
So when Jesus says to Peter, when Jesus says to the incorruptible substance, don't give me language, don't give me flowery praise language without also going and doing the work with the least and the lowest, which is the metaphor for everybody.
And meaning the sheep, like go be a shepherd, go get stinky.
Yes.
He's saying go get stinky.
Go get your hands dirty.
Yeah, interesting. It just made me think of it. Well, go ahead. I don't want to derail you.
No.
Ram Dass talked to Maharaji and he said, tell the truth, always tell the truth. And then he said, love everybody. Mm-hmm. Those are the two lessons he gave him. And he was stuck with this conundrum of like, if I tell the truth, I don't love everybody. You know what I mean? But he was trying to get him to that place of get in with the sheep.
Yes. I mean, this is about be authentic in service, not perfection.
Mm-hmm.
Not a paragon of virtue that's beyond where any of us really live.
Well, I'm glad you brought up perfection because that's something Rob and I kick around a lot is the idea of perfection not being final.
Mm-mm.
But we all look at it that way.
Yeah.
God is perfect. I love, just as a thought experiment, I love being like, I wonder what if an aspect of this thing, metaphor for a mystery, we call God, is always continuing to perfect. Because nobody likes a stagnant pond. Everybody likes the river.
Yeah.
But we think it goes like, it means I vote this way. It means I am a non-smoker. It means I do not curse. It means I do not have sex outside of wedlock. Or I do not watch The Sopranos or whatever it is. Yeah. And that makes me perfect. And then I'm done.
And that's the fallacy of the beginning moment of the third path when we got the scintillating feeling.
Yes.
We lock that feeling down on certain attributes or qualities of the people who brought us to that feeling.
The method.
Yes, and then we think that's it.
You get lost in the method. This is, again, Ram Dass talks about,
yeah,
you don't want to be a Christian, you want to be free. You don't want to be a Jew, you want to be free. You don't want to be a meditator, you want to be free. You want to be free, you want to be free, you want to be free. And I'm paraphrasing here, but he talks about any decent method, once it traps you, will have the decency after it's taught you to self-destruct. So you're left without method. But then he goes, but the tricky thing is the method only works if it traps you.
Yes.
So we get stuck in the ritual and the communion or the Passover or whatever, or the meditation or the yoga, whatever it was. But in the getting trapped, we learn how to shed it,
right,
which is an absurd thought, right, that Jesus shows up to kick it in your heart only to leave at the end and leave you alone and go like, I've taught you what you need, yeah, and you don't need to hang your hat on these – on this vocabulary anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. And this is exactly, in the way that I see it, the meditations in the middle of the text of John are about exactly that. Don't get trapped in the method and then understand the freedom that comes.
That's right. You're not trapped. You're not trapped at all?
No, you're not.
This was a method. This was what got you there. And honestly, I'll take whatever I can get.
And you need it.
I need whatever I can get. Yes, please. So here we are in John, and we're being mystical, right, and we're learning the force.
So now we're being sent out to go take care of the sheep, and we turn the page, and now we're looking at the opening of Luke.
Yes.
And Luke is written to a group late in the first century. They have now been criminalized.
Christians.
Yes. But they're not criminalized for the name of Jesus. They're criminalized because how they're living their life, which is higher respect for women. Emperor didn't want any part of that. If you have wealth, you have an obligation to share some of it with those less. Emperor wanted none of that. Emperor wanted none of this idea that everybody, no matter who their mother was, could sit at the table of respect with each other. For all of these ways...
Sounds like hippies.
Well, yeah.
It sounds like the uncorrupted hippie.
Well, the uncorrupted hippie or the hobo or whoever.
Yeah, it sounds like kung fu.
But Christianity was very countercultural in its values in the first century.
Yes.
And because of the way we lived, the emperor was writhing in anger because he knew that if these values got started, his power was over.
Fucking A.
And what Christianity's response is, it's like, how are we going to face such oppression by government?
Mm-hmm.
And we have the text of Luke Acts, which in some ways is one of the world's first texts of nonviolent resistance.
Is that right?
Yes.
Please tell me.
Well, Jesus lived this way in the face of oppression and was led to his death. Peter and Paul in the Acts of the Apostles lived this way in the face of oppression, and they both died. You probably are going to die if you want to truly live these values.
For this.
For this.
That's what Rob says. All these enlightened people are either shot something or limping.
Yeah.
Shot shunned or limping. Or all three. Well, we see that we see this in a literal reality with your Martin Luther King. Right. We see it time and time again.
Martin Luther King has this beautiful phrase from the early 60s. He said, and this has real impact for me knowing part of my family history, send your hooded perpetrators into our neighborhoods at the midnight hour. Send them. Beat our children. Burn our homes. And break our bones, and we will not hate you. We cannot in good conscience obey unjust laws, and we will win our freedom. But we will so appeal to your heart and to your conscience by our ability to suffer that when we win our freedom, it will be twofold, for we will have won yours as well. Now, the one piece, you know, from 50 years ago that I might argue with Martin Luther King about is, I think today it might be better to say, we will so appeal to your heart and your conscience by our ability to love. And I, in these instances, other people may look at us and see suffering, but in ourselves, what we know is it's love.
That's right. Unconditional love, man, comes up on this show constantly. You're reminding me of a story Ram Dass tells, too, about a monk, and there's an occupying army, and they're killing all the monks, and there's this one monk that won't leave the monastery, and this infuriates the sergeant, or whatever you want to call him, and he storms in personally, and this is like a bloodthirsty maniac, and he goes up to the monk, and he's like, why didn't you flee into the mountains? Don't you know who I am? I could pass my sword through your stomach, and I wouldn't bat an eye. And the monk says, don't you know who I am? You could pass your sword through my stomach, and I wouldn't bat an eye. And I'm just like, get out of here when you hear stuff like that. I don't care if that's real. That's true. That's what we're looking for, which is this idea of non-judging, non-resisting, unconditional love, even for your enemy. So Martin Luther King Jr. fighting for the freedom of his oppressors? Smells like Jesus in here.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
And there is something in us that knows that this is true, which is not about show me the DNA, show me where he stood.
Right.
Show me the correct transcript of that moment.
Right.
You just know it.
Is it the Holy Sepulchre or is it this other one? Yeah. Which rock do I touch to speak in tongues and have a vision?
Yeah.
How about no rock?
Well, yeah. I mean,
Christianity has gotten way off track because it lost being the tradition of here and now. Mm. And that was its glory. It did not appeal to history. Hmm. Yes, I believe Jesus was born, died, and rose. But unless you can experience that same vitality and that same nobility of life now, that's just a story.
That's right. The past is a tricky, it's a mind fuck, for lack of a better term, anyway. Ram Dass calls it moldering butterflies, of this beautiful image of a butterfly on fire. Jack Kornfield talks about how everything's gone. The beginning of this podcast is gone. Yes. When I met you, it's gone. He says, with the pharaohs and the dinosaurs. Yeah. I'm like, oh my God. So everything has to be here and now. It really is a waste of time to throw your line over the wall of the past and see what you can catch. It's gone. It only applies to what it can do for you right now.
Yes.
And we're suffocating in, like, what's real? Which is real? A Catholic or Protestant or this or that or that? Is this one, the Prophet Muhammad, was it his cousin or was it his brother-in-law? You know, like, and then we'll have a war over that. But at the end of the day, it's whether or not we can take these hums and these groans inside and fix, or not fix, but evolve ourselves.
Right. Right.
Why isn't everybody saying this?
Many people are.
I agree with you, but I'm 36 years old and I just found my first one 3 years ago. Yeah. In Rob. Yeah. And now I'm meeting you, which I'm so grateful to share this with the people.
Sort of to go cosmic as we come towards the end.
Please.
There is a way, I mean, Campbell didn't describe this. I don't know whether he knew the science of it at that moment, but there's a way that energy moves. Mm. And our job is, through the authentic, noble life for each one of us, is to move with what is, to move with the way energy is. And that the first moment of a new cycle is the energy flares forth. Mm. And Campbell calls that hearing the summons. I call that facing change. Mm. And then immediately after that, the energy moves in an opposition. It moves out from each other, and it creates a valence and a tension. Mm. Campbell calls that moving through the obstacles. I call that the suffering and the trials. Mm-hmm. Then the energy comes back together in an electric moment of new synthesis. Campbell called that receiving the boon. I call that receiving joy and knowing union. Mm. And then this new vital energy moves forward for a while before it comes back around and the cycle lessens and it moves back through a new birth cycle again. That moving forward, Campbell called returning to community. I call it maturing in service. Mm. This pattern is what's true. And mm-hmm. every great myth and every great religious tradition and every great spirituality, if it's going to endure and serve us,
it follows that.
It follows the pattern.
And we know this. I mean, Jung talks about archetypes and deep things that keep coming back and keep coming out of us as means of expressing this thing that you're expressing as energy, right. And
I don't use the word God very much. To me, it's a verb. It's a knowing intelligence which is moving through everything, but it moves by this pattern. Hmm. And we can see this pattern in Buddhism, as we've got the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. And the first noble truth is impermanence, and the second is suffering, and the third is non-attachment, and the fourth is the Eightfold Path of Right Relationship. Mm. There it is again, that we now know that the truth is not just in the words, but it's coming out of this one seed that's moving everywhere.
That's right. That we call God.
That we call God.
But it's one. Yes. Get out of here. I love it so much. I'd be remiss, because this is something that I would stumble. Rob and I love to talk about the idea of sin, right? And I think it's such a beautiful thing. He calls it disrupting shalom, disrupting this flow. So there are things that connect and unify and enlighten and beautify and rapturize and glorify. And then there are things that separate and isolate and shame and scare and fill you with fear, right? Yeah. And somehow that glorious idea that if I'm unkind to you because you're Lebanese, that's separating us and that's breaking up unity. That's breaking up the idea that you and I are brothers or, you know, part of this whole thing. So that's a sin. But then sin got turned into spitting on the sidewalk or whatever it is. You know what I mean? Got turned into internet pornography, which it's funny. The longer I study it, I understand maybe the idea that internet pornography is isolating and it might be encouraging ideas in your brain that aren't necessarily your highest self. But it got turned into sin and that's the end of it. Yeah. Oh, you jerked off to pornography. You sinned and you need to confess. Instead of trying to get in that flow, be a part, following your bliss, following your calling. People always talk about when they start doing the thing that they feel like they were meant to do, doors opening where there were no doors before, and getting that sense, that serendipitous sense that you're on that right path. And that is apart from sin. And that is a story that everybody wants to hear. Yes. But as soon as I say, like, you got to go to church instead of watching football or whatever it is, how did we get there?
I mean, for me, the beautiful phrase about following the bliss, it's like following the journey, following your authentic journey, which is going to have great obstacles and trials.
Yep.
But you will be held and endured through it.
That's right. I was just having this conversation. I'm divorced, and my father was asking me why, if I regard my divorce as a failure. And that just seems so preposterous to me. But if you had asked me when I was 28, I might have. Mm. And that's that next – I'm not saying it's better. It's just that next level of thinking where I was like, what are you talking about? God put me in the – God or my life put me in the boat at night and it knew there'd be a storm.
Right.
There is no pleasure without suffering. You know what I mean? Would have – I sometimes hypothesize what heaven could be. It would have to be like that. You know what I mean? If it's another reality that we're sniffing, smelling, touching, tasting, relating, it would have to include some sort of discomfort. This is the craziest thing in the world.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I have got this crazy pattern going. About every 20 years, my life just hits what others might consider the skids. And nothing works. And it's just, I'm brought down to my knees. Mm. And I've just come out of a period like that. Mm. And yet, in this moment, as the new infilling and all this new vitality and new thoughts and new creativity is beginning to flow again, wow. Mm.
Because you know.
I wouldn't change a thing.
That's what Rob says. He goes, the word you want to use is grateful.
Yes.
I've come to a place where I, without a doubt, put my divorce as the best thing that ever happened to me. And not for that all-American way where I'm like, I gotta have sex with other people and I drink beer during the day. It's not that. It's because there was no other way to get my attention. Yeah. I would still be back there. A baby. A childish baby. And something happened and I was forced to face some Darth Vaders and some dragons and some aliens. Yeah. And that's what it's all about. God.
And look what you're offering people. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. This is the best thing I've ever done. I can't thank you enough. Well, there's, you know, it doesn't need to be unified. Just the number of people that I can meet that can talk about Christ or Buddha or God or whatever in a way that is actually compelling. Mm. That's authentic, and you said it yourself. You know when it's real. Mm-hmm. You just know it. We know it viscerally. Yeah. It's like watching someone pass away and feeling the life leave their body, and you go like, I knew something was happening. Yeah. And you can't fake that. Yeah. And everything, in my experience, has just been turned into like a members-only club and secret jackets and stupid songs that I don't agree with. When I would go back to church, it was the songs that actually bothered me the most. I was like, I don't believe that. I don't believe you believe that. I shouldn't be judging, but that's what I would be doing. And to come into something authentic is truly riveting. And that's what Campbell was saying.
There is something very vital that's going on. And I get to play out on the edges, and I get to see all the new seeds and the new sprouts.
Yes.
It's exciting.
It is exciting.
And thank you for being part of whatever this is that new that's happening.
Thank you, man.
You know, it's like, because what you're doing your authentic life. And that's what we have to have today.
I completely agree. And that's something Rob said. We need you to be you. Go do you and do it to the wall.
I mean, and I realize I am wildly optimistic right now when people go, how can you be in the face of what we've got going on the planet right now? How can you be wildly optimistic? Mm. I know the journey.
Yeah.
I know that everybody, when they're on that second place on the journey, feels like they're facing an insurmountable obstacle.
Mm.
And what's happening right now is that so many of us on the planet are waking up to the fact that we feel like we're facing an insurmountable obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
Because you know the story.
I know the story.
And it keeps happening again and again and
yes.
again and again.
Yes.
And this is why we get the chills in the third act of the movie as we go,
right.
Oh, I thought it was – I don't know if you've – I've studied screenwriting. Thing, okay, hero, we meet the guy. Something changes. He's an inciting incident happens, usually about 15 minutes in, 20 minutes in. Everything's play in the middle. Something goes wrong. That's fine. Usually that gets resolved. Then something gets worse, and we have the dark night of the soul where, no, we could solve that first one, but we can't solve this second one.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that second one is solved. But we all love going, oh, I knew he'd get over that. I thought the movie was over.
Yeah.
And then that no, now it's really done. We fall for it every time. And the crazy thing is we fall for it in our own lives.
We do. We fall for it personally and collectively.
Yes.
It's not over.
Yeah.
It's not. I mean, I can't wait to see how it turns out, but I know it's going to be okay.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's amazing. This seems like the wrong question to ask. But I'm going to ask it, because I ask everybody this. Is death the end?
Not for me.
What do you mean?
I don't know what continues.
Yeah.
But I know something continues.
I've been going back to that idea. In fact, it was in my dream last night, this idea that it's all Campbell talks about when a janitor changes a light bulb, he has no real regard for the worn-out light bulb. He just throws that away, and then he puts in a new bulb. But what we care about is the light.
Yeah.
And he's trying to get us to identify with the light and not the bulb. So I think we might experience some sort of ego death. I don't know if my awareness carries on in that regard. But when Maharaji, Ram Dass's guy, was dying of cancer, they were like, don't leave us. And he said, where could I go?
Mm-hmm.
Where could I go?
Right.
So I don't know if that means reincarnation or some sort of recycling or just – it's all this. This is God expressing itself over and over and over. And I take great hope in that. Talking about teaching and sprouts and stuff, I run into so many people personally where I'm like, I'll never reach you. Not that it's my job to reach anybody, but I can't help. What's helped me, I can't share with you. And then this monk I remember told me, he was like, some people just need another turn around. They need to go around another couple times. And I do take comfort in that. I just said a lot. I just answered the question I asked you, but what do you think?
We know that matter is never destroyed.
Yep.
I know that something of myself continues. Maybe it's my Semitic poetic metaphor that doesn't need to have a linear answer.
Yeah. You know, man, an explanation, this is from Finding Joe, an explanation is so inferior to a story.
Yeah.
Oh, God, we're explanation addicts.
Yeah.
Yeah. What has it got us?
Yeah.
Gets us iPhones.
Yeah.
Gets us GPS. This was amazing. I feel satisfied. Do you feel satisfied?
I'm satisfied. I might be able to sleep on the plane now.
Yeah, I've worn you out.
Long sleep.
I know that you have shared all of this many times again, but for what it's worth, tens of thousands of new people that would never have been exposed to something like this are going to hear... I know what I'm hearing is the result of a lot of work and a lot of dragon slaying and a lot of hero's journeys. Not just one, but you keep going around and around.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful for you. Thank you for this.
Well, you're welcome. I probably should mention my website.
Please.
Which is Quadratus. This whole idea about the fourness of the journey.
Yeah.
Quad, Ra, Tos, T-O-S.
Okay.
T-U-A-D-R-A-T-O-S.com.
And your book is called, now it's called?
Heart and Mind.
Heart and Mind.
God. On Kindle everywhere.
Audio?
Not audio
you
yet.
Got a good speaking voice. You sound like Billy Bob
Thank
Thornton
you.
In
Thank
Fargo.
You. Thank you.
Do you remember the hardest time you've ever laughed? Just the throwaway last question.
The hardest time I've ever laughed.
Which people always like to correct me. It's the time you laugh the hardest. But I like saying the hardest time you've
ever laughed. Yes.
Please tell us.
Long ago in college, and one of my dearest friends had left for a weekend, and a group of us got together, and piece of paper by piece of paper, we filled up his entire room. 6 feet high, 9 by 10.
Crumpled
paper. And waited for him to come back after being with his family that weekend.
Those are long minutes.
And we laughed until we just cried.
Did he laugh?
He laughed.
Oh, boy.
He laughed. And then we all helped him de-empty his room.
Of course.
But there was that wonderful moment when he couldn't open the door.
Yes.
Yeah.
Multicolored paper. I want to picture
yes,
it.
Yes.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, through the transom. Howard Hall, University of Notre Dame.
Go Irish. Yay. Not just my lineage. I would say God love you, but I'm going to say may a metaphor for mystery that transcends all categories of human thought, including being and non-being, love you.
Hallelujah.
This was awesome, man. Would you say keep it crispy? It's just how we end. Would you say that you have to...
Keep it crispy.
It's confusing. Thank you, man.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.